Hello. I'm going to be discussing some of the inadequacies we found in the current evaluation systems which regulate genetically modified organisms worldwide and help recognize the scientific basis for those inadequacies. Recombinant DNA technology has dramatically changed the face of agriculture, and the utilization of recombinant DNA technology has revolutionized pest management. Let's not squander this valuable technology with irresponsible evaluation procedures. The evaluation procedures are designed to protect human health and the environment by evaluating risk to the consumer and the agricultural industry. If the scientific principles behind the evaluation procedures do not measure the current biological variables in question, then they cannot apply to the relevant risk factors involved. Regulations are only as adequate as they are scientifically sound. The regulations, regulatory bodies, and evaluation procedures were originally designed to encompass all recombinant DNA technology. They were not formulated for one specific genetically modified organism. This is why we can't limit the scope of this debate to BT or one specific GMO, because the evaluation procedures inadequacies relate to all GMOs to which the regulations apply. When an unexpected physiological change occurs, why aren't there any evaluation procedures to investigate and ensure the longevity of the GMO commodity involved? One example of a documented physiological change between a GMO and its non-transgenic counterpart is increased lignin content in corn. Why does an insecticidal protein change the physiology of the plant in this manner? When an unexpected change occurs, why don't the regulations require a biochemical study or further biochemical evaluation? Shouldn't complete unknowns raise biological questions? Here are some examples of negative impacts on the health of the organism which directly correlate to physiological changes. Domingo 2007 warns that since microvilli in mice were disrupted due to cry1 intoxication, to avoid risk to consumers, further genomic studies need to be performed before releasing transgenic foods. Worcester rats fed GM soy have reproductive disabilities such as pup stillbirths and low birth weights. The insertion of snowdrop lectin, an insecticidal protein, into potato caused stunted growth and damaged internal organs in rats. Another GMO caused liver, pancreas, and intestine modification in Swiss mice. How can we correlate these health risks to a seemingly harmless gene or protein? Epigenetics. A definition of epigenetics is a system regulating gene expression above the genome level, and therefore not directly related to the insertion event. Two identical genotypes can correspond to different phenotypes, which implicate BT or other genes causing unintended expression. There are unanalyzed factors impacting gene expression, which no regulations currently address. In contrast, the FDA uses a comparative approach of substantial equivalence to determine the safety of genetically modified food by comparing nutritional data to non-transformed food and by comparing against known allergenicity data. There are new studies which incorporate scientific, peer-reviewed methodology to establish substantial equivalence between transformed and non-transformed isogenic lines based upon statistically significant differences. Substantial equivalence was an excellent starting point, but as current researchers investigate GMOs further, they have expanded the scope of substantial equivalence, rendering the previous approach outdated. By putting into perspective all of the factors we have discussed, the lack of enforcement evaluation procedures to prevent contamination of the non-GM food supply becomes crucial. Preventing problems such as volunteers from crops planted the previous year, misplaced shipments, pollen dispersal, the mixing and saving of seed all fall under the responsibility of regulatory enforcement. There was a study performed where growers were administered a questionnaire over the telephone. An exhausting percentage were unclear about proper regulatory practices. Lack of enforcement jeopardizes human health and the environment, which the regulations were designed to protect. This may be one of the reasons gene flow events can occur. BT sugar beets can transfer antibiotic resistance to soil microbiota, and there was a gene flow event from BT sunflower to wild sunflower. Lack of enforcement could also lead to gene flow events caused by pollen dispersal. There are no regulations which address the human health and environmental impacts of insect vector manipulation. Let's address the gene silencing of any kind of recombinant DNA technology. Gene silencing is a natural immune response initiated by the genetically modified organism, which negates how it was engineered. This mechanism may leave unprepared, susceptible populations at risk. And although the novelty of transgenic insects is beneficial to human health, there are no regulations which scientifically address the trial and release of GM insects. What we would all love to prevent is a negative reputation surrounding GMO food. The consequences of bad publicity are immeasurable. You can analyze economic risk, but risk in the mind of the consumer can be blown way out of proportion. Society believes, especially in a panic, that the industry only retains the right to regulate itself in the absence of threat to the public. Thank you.
You mentioned snowdrop lectins in one of your early slides. Are snowdrop lectins available for commercial use?
They're not currently available for commercial use, but the whole point of this is that they are going to be pushed out for commercial use.
Thank you, Gordon.
You're welcome.
In the Domingo paper about the tests on human health, how does the length of time of the test relate to the stringency of the test?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that again?
How does the length of time relate to the stringency of the test, and how many of them are actually related to entomology, the organisms in question?
I have a good question. So you mentioned genetically modified crop.
I have to respond to that question first.
As one of the cases that we've looked in and being evaluated on, that this was a GMs looking at how they directly affect entomology. But the other umbrelling regulatory procedures that go into GMs are not specific to BT or insecticide proteins. So we have to look at some of these events, especially in the epigenetic causes, where we're having changes being occurred at the genome level, especially at the functional genomics level. So this is why we included those.
So you mentioned that. So you mentioned that there was a horizontal gene transfer in the way sunflower to sunflower. So do you know how many years it will take for horizontal transfer?
The sunflower to sunflower was transferred to wild sunflower from cultivated sunflower.
These sunflowers are being released commercially?
No, they're not available commercially, but this shows that it can happen.
I believe the evaluation procedures they are for commercial release of the genetically GMOs.
What we were trying to clarify is that these events can occur and
excuse
that
me,
the regulations
your answer.
Do not currently.
You got your answer. Our question is your slide was saying that right now the world is not prepared for and is really unprepared for GM rates or GM crops or organisms. Do you have any specific data related to entomology?
For what? I'm sorry?
Can you repeat that?
I was referring to a couple of your, not a couple of specifically about your slide, which says we are unprepared for GM at this point. Can you clarify this?
Are you referring to susceptible populations because of insect vector manipulation?
That's a question, actually.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
Oh, well, what happened?
We're going to start the rebuttals, so use that as one of the first rebuttals. So, did you want to have us answer your question? Sorry?
So, you mentioned one of the survey concluded this surveyed the telephonic survey to the farmers? Did they survey the same set of farmers?
Did you say sensor?
No, he's asking, did the survey ask the same farm, were the same farmers surveyed in all aspects of the survey?
Yes, I believe the questionnaire was the same for all people they surveyed.
But were the individuals who answered the survey the same people every time?
There was only one survey.
It was just a questionnaire to exhibit that there's miscommunication between regulatory procedures and the growers who are supposed to follow the regulatory procedures. So there's a communication break between what the regulatory bodies are saying to the
growers.
So
you can answer this when you're in your rebuttal.
This is the rebuttal.
We're in
the rebuttal. Yeah. Okay. So we also noticed in your slides just saying that there is the regulation is not addressing the chronic level of impact on the usage, but it's not true. EPA strictly evaluates the chronic level of insects in terms of studying the life history of the invertebrates that is associated with specific crops, especially invertebrates such as earthworms, mites, columbolans, etc. They are studied as long as 6 months. That is why for 6 months they just refer to have the contact, how much they are having their exposure.
Okay, so you mentioned a concern about insect manipulation.
It's now the cons team for rebuttal.
To kind of readdress the toxicology of what we were talking about earlier, is as you even stated when I asked about if you could explain the toxicology, you said that they would ingest the protein and then recheck and recheck after 14 days. That's still an acute toxicology test where you're applying one time and checking later on, whereas what we're concerned about is chronic, where you're going to be feeding these things day after day after day, which is what was done in the epigenetics feeding trials that we mentioned earlier. Whether these things are being put out for commercialization or not, you know, that the evaluation procedures do move for that, but we have to look at it's like, especially in gene silencing events, which we mentioned, that these products that are put out to the market, that they could have a gene silencing event to cause another phenotypic epigenetic change, which therefore could cause some problem that is not picked up from these regulatory and evaluation procedures. So it's something we very need to address. And one of the things I was noticing earlier when you mentioned about reduces carbon usage and for gasoline and the use of tractors and such. At the same time, a lot of these we were putting a lot of these implementations in. We were also noticing we had a renewing in IPM programs, reducing the amount of times that we have to put out pesticides, whether they're insecticides, herbicides, or whatever. Fewer times we're having to go across the fields. Couldn't that also be a part of the reason why we're having reducing carbon usage instead of just for the direct impact of GMO insects, or GMO insect-related crops?
These practices were there before also. After introducing GM crop, especially BT cotton, the amount of the pesticide load or carbon byproducts which are emitting into the environment, that totally, not totally, comparatively decrease.
Okay, so the pro team has 2 minutes for rebuttal.
With respect to your to the chronic and acute situation, the EPA strictly states that if a protein has no unusual persistence in the digestive fluids and shows no toxicity in acute oral toxicity tests, why is there reason to believe that this protein would behave any differently than any other dietary protein and would induce longer term toxicity testing? The fact that something has not been commercialized and it's not been commercialized, that means it's still under testing. It's still under evaluation. So if you find some negative consequences to or negative concepts about a particular product, it's hard to say that until all the evaluation has been completed. And clearly those are examples where this has not passed for regulation, it's not been commercialized. I also want to state that risk is something in the mind of the consumer. And it's also something that's based on probability, it's also based on event. And I think that when we overtest and we spend a lot of time, don't you think that overtesting causes irrational fear in consumers and the public?
I think that the perception is that there's not enough testing in many cases. And as far as the EPA's testing of protein, I don't think the EPA is taking into effect possible epigenetic into account possible epigenetic effects and secondary metabolites, which might be produced by the insertion of this gene.
So all those uncertainties or effects will be determined by the scientific advisory committee. They can predict within the scientific knowledge. So these are uncertainties there behind scientific expectations. As and when these kinds happen, they will improve improve the existing regulatory system to address all these problems.
And another question, so in your reference you mentioned
the Khan team has time for 2 minutes for rebuttal, and then we'll go to judges' questions.
So one of the things that we both felt very well established is that GMOs are becoming a very integral part and very important part of the agriculture industry. And essentially, they have become the oil pipeline for the future of agriculture. And now, it's something that we can, as with oil, that we can get by without it, but it's going to be extremely difficult. And we're here actually as saying that we should remove GMOs, but we need to do more to ensure that market is there, and it's going to be there for the future. And that's why when we were asked to evaluate this, and we first looked at the standard of substantial equivalence first set up by the FDA in 1992, they even admitted that it was a starting point. This is where we need to start. We need to look at how we're going to evaluate these procedures. And it's been 16 years since then, and from since then our technology has changed. We've learned more about the genomics, and we're starting to see that we are getting epigenetics. We are getting what is determined in the Domingo paper as some clonal variations. And some things need to be reevaluated. We need to relook at these. One of the things we brought up earlier was the Starling corn. And in fact, we were very lucky as proponents of the GM industry that there wasn't a major case. But on the edge of that was the fact that the CDC took a closer look at it because they did get approximately 30 people calling in saying, I've got an allergy, I saw the news, I had the Taco Bell shells. Well, that right there is going to hurt, and it's going to damage the image of the GMO industry. And we have to try to prevent those and look at and reevaluate those, because when the CDC did the testing, they took samples from the company. They didn't take the samples from what these people ingested. So it very well could have been an epigenetic event. It could have been something that wasn't caught. So we need to further keep looking at these. And here, in the case of gene flow problems, I think that's about time, right? Thank you. And one of the...
Can we respond to
this? It's our time. Yeah. It's our statement.
Thank you. And one of the problems
we now have questions from the judges, and I ask that each team limit their response to 1 minute. We'll start with Dr. Reagans, and the protein can answer. If you have a question for both sides, the protein will answer first.
Okay. For the protein, I don't think the mic's working. That's all right. There we go. Little switch there. IPM, we don't hear much about IPM when we talk about transgenics. And one of the issues that was mentioned by an early team is IPM is critically needed. And in many fields with transgenic technologies are treated that aren't necessarily needed. So their point was in there that basic concept of incongruency with the concept of sustainability in IPM, because you're getting a lot of selection pressure on maybe organisms that don't need to be controlled, whether they're pest or non-target or whatnot. What's your position on that?
So the BT cotton is one of the component of IPM. So we have our different IPM measures.
But if it's treated and not needed, then it's not IPM.
So it's not treated when it's not needed. So if treated, if it crosses EDL or DAL.
If it has a BP component and that BP component is not needed.
Could it be
Then it's impossible for GM. It is impossible for GM plants, if you're going to use that definition of IPM, to be included under IPM then.
I think that was one of the earlier team's whole theory with their whole concept.
But if that is the definition, that you can only use it in a prophylactic sense, then how can you possibly adhere it to that definition? Therefore, the economic injury level, you have to determine that in advance. If this is an area that is prone to the level of devastation by insects, then the prophylactic then would be to use GM products.
I think that's a very good answer, because if you do have an area where you do have a situation where they're prone to have a very severe pest problem, then maybe it is almost always needed. Okay, so what's your concept about the issue of safety with transgenic technology? That's one of their main points, is that transgenic technology is safety. Do you have a response to that?
Are you asking us to provide an alternative to some of the evaluation procedures? Or I'm just trying to clarify your question. Okay. Well, one of the biggest points that was actually pointed out in the Domingo paper, and was even noted in the some of the other references we have, is that they were noticing that something called somaclonal variation, something that goes back to the epigenetics. And they were saying that, yeah, sure, well, you have this concept of substantial equivalence. We have the germline breed, and we have the transgenic breed from that germline, but they're not quite mixing, and there's something that's not quite working right. So one of the things that an author has proposed was actually using gene knockouts. In other words, take the transgene, knock out that same event, and then use those as the true substantial equivalence to really truly find out if we're having epigenetic effects or if this is something else that's going on. It's more of a truer study instead of just looking at comparing to the parental line.
I think sometimes there's a safety issue involved in comparison to maybe broad spectrum pesticides, but we're getting back very quickly into the realm of narrow range minimum risk pesticides, so that's a whole other concept of safety.
Other questions from the judges?
So my question to both teams. The topic asked about genetically modified organisms will be very much focused on genetically modified plants. So partly why are you focused on plants so much? And also just some comments on some of the issues you've raised relevant to really sort of AGM insects to control diseases, which was the topic of the first debate.
The COG team will answer first.
We actually did talk about that in one of the big papers from the Pew Initiative was the evaluation of using the insect vector manipulation. And one of the biggest health concerns they actually brought up in that paper was the phenomenon of gene silencing. And that is actually the self-immune response that could be brought about by an insect vector. Let's say that we put in some sort of genetic modification to where they become competent. Well, every DNA mechanism has their own machinery as sort of to maintain, make sure, to try to reject foreign DNA. So if we were to, in the case of, let's say, for malaria, insert a gene or add something to make them incompetent, if a gene silencing effect was to occur, it could cause it where we're releasing all of these supposedly incompetent vectors, which have now, because of gene silencing, have become competent and actually just exacerbated the problem instead of solving it.
And currently there are no regulatory procedures to analyze these field trials or field tests, although the organisms themselves have been addressed in the lab, just not in the field.
Look, the real judge of genetically modified in this sense, in the scope of this debate, has to do with what is commercialized. That is the real judge. That is what has gone through evaluation and regulation and release. Those are the ones we can really look at the before and after picture for, okay? So the vast majority of those crops are BT plants, and as we're talking about insect control, then the highest percentage of them out there would be BT plants. Of course, I can give you a couple of examples of, you know, some squash or papaya that have protein coats that make them resistant to insect vector viruses, and those are commercially available, but there's just a couple of them. So really, the giant piece of the pie is BT plants. And that's why we gave them so much emphasis. I mean, that's 287.1 million acres grown worldwide. Papaya is a mere drop in the bucket.
So to add to this, there is no commercially ready to release genetically modified insect at this point. So regulation is on the way. That's how everything works.
Do we have a question from the other judge?
Yeah, I just had a question. Am I able to ask questions, a general question for both teams?
Yes, the pro team will answer first.
Oh, okay. This comes from maybe tying it all together a little bit, and really from an extension background, which is what I do in mostly in my profession or my position. We've talked a lot in this debate about, I would say, the scientific evaluation procedures, which, as you've all discussed very well, this is really the core of this debate. And the point that was just made about, you know, these things have become, and in some cases not, become commercially available through the regulation processes, which are very well defined. Thinking about farmers and the general public as well, and also educators that may not have the scientific background that many here in the room and certainly on both debate panels have, this is just a general question, and it's, you know, there's not necessarily any right or wrong answers, but I'm curious, as sort of representing farmers and the general public, do you see gaps between regulatory details and processes, and really how farmers and maybe the general public understand this in practice? It may not be related to the literature. This is a very general question to kind of close things out, I mean, from a real practical perspective.
We discussed in our argument what are the current procedures in action now, and according to us, the evaluation is, we can only evaluate as far as to the limits of science. We are doing every possible way to ensure that the evaluation is foolproof, and that is reflected in the number of commercially available GMOs.
So, as an industry, we all these regulatory bodies and involvement of universities to educate farmers, all of, like, integratedly, they are trying best to understand the farmer about the current technology.
And to add to this, there was a certain instance like Starlink that came up. That is not a regulatory problem. Regulation was very, very accurate on that. It's only for the feed, not for the public use, but it's operative. And this is bringing up enforcement and bringing more regulation into the further in the future. So it's evolving in that direction.
I'll first address your question. So to the gaps that occur between the regulatory agencies and the farmers and the growers that we saw, and that the crops that still exist in the environment before they're completely deregulated and commercially available, we've seen, let's see, but once they're actually deregulated and commercially available, the studies stop, the evaluations, the stringent evaluations stop, and before they're deregulated and they're actually in crops and in the field, but not commercially available, and those are the inconsistencies that we talked about in our actual debate, the gene transfer in those areas. So that's what we first saw, and also we mentioned the study where the growers were asked questions over the phone just informally, and there was a huge differences in answers about what the regulations are, what they are supposed to be doing, and what concerned me most about that was why they're doing it. The regulations have, the principles behind the regulations are to protect the health in the environment, the human health in the environment, and if the growers don't understand that, there was obvious disconnects there, so that was a concern for me.
Okay, while the judges kind of put their heads together and figure out which team made a better argument, while the teams can accept questions from the audience, do you have any?
Yes. It's a question for both the teams, reacting to the question the judge had, the last question. I think GMO is a very good concept. It has both pros and cons, but the real gaps, which he's asking about, what are the real gaps in terms of farmers and the technology? I think everybody has to think about the third world countries, like the Asian countries, where they don't have access to this technology. It's not the technology you're developing. You should have access to the farmers. And I think everybody has to think about that. The economics aspect and access to the technology. Those are the critical things for any research to be successful. I just wanted to add that part because I've been listening to these system in India, they're economically poor farmers. They can't afford to do these technologies. So,
okay.
Would either team like to address that?
Can,
yeah.
Can I clarify?
Yeah.
In fact, in developing countries like India and China, most of the cotton is under BT cotton now. So it's not that they don't have a technology. They do have a technology. So
I'm saying the access to technology, I'm not talking about technology, the access to the people to the, for the technology.
But like to make the plants, you mean?
I mean like, you know, in terms of India, there are lots of use with BT cotton in the like where the poor farmers would not afford to buy the BT seed. So the technology is available, but the efficiency of the farmers or the economics of the farmers.
So if you compare to the cotton seeds and also the pesticide they invest on to spray on BT
right.
cotton, so they can afford the BT cotton seed instead of buying pesticide and also cotton seed.
To address your question, there are some international regulatory agencies that are attempting to fill the gaps between second world and third world countries, however you want to address that nomenclature, between what we have in the U.S. and what Europe has, but there's an ongoing debate of whether or not these methodologies are going to be scientifically peer-reviewed methodologies that are ongoing, or whether we're just going to put them in a database and everyone just follow them as best you can. And of course, there's the enforcement issue, which is obviously going to be different. So I think if everyone would have an international regulatory body that would make sense scientifically, then they would want to regulate themselves in terms of what's beneficial for them, what's most beneficial to keep their GMO going.
It's the very point as you bring in the developing countries is that it is a shame that we can't get these great technologies to them. But also, and because it would benefit them greatly, as we both have stated all and everybody has all day, by the importance of GMOs, especially the importance of GMOs to the industrialized agriculture. One of the biggest problems they even have with agriculture going to these third world countries is that premium price that has to come with it. And it's like, well, can we give them some sort of a break so that developing countries can get that? But at the same time, we have to ensure the capitalist rights that these people who develop these technologies and that their intellectual property rights are also sustained. So there's a little bit of, there's always, as with everything, some politics and socioeconomics involved.
The both teams were told to focus on current U.S. evaluations, but to use worldwide regulatory procedures for background information. Do we have time for one more question?
Yes, please. Let me ask you this. And if we don't know what is the effect of GMO on healthy of human or animal, and how do GMO are developing in the United States, Europe, and Western countries, even the developing country doesn't have technology 100% yet, but we're still standing, seeing the developing country, but we don't know what is the effect. Now, if you are in the position to make a decision, that's for the both teams. What is the decision? Are you gonna go ahead and continue to send no GMO in developing countries, even if you don't know what is the effect at the by begin working on for 1 or 20 years? What is your decision gonna be? That is common sense.
I think on the one hand, it's almost unethical to limit progress in commerce in another country. But on the other hand, by limiting them, they may not have the best crop yields, but they won't be causing adverse health effects. In the 1970s, there was something called the Green Revolution, and they pushed pesticides so much in certain countries, and they had these great crop yields for a certain number of years, but then there was fallout. Of course, improper use of pesticides leads to resistance, and these huge resistant populations with like Helicobacter pyridae, and it was a really bad fallout, and the federalized government of those countries had to step in and go to growers' farms and tell them, no, you can't use it, period, and actually pull them out of their fields and stop what they were doing. And so I think that the consequences could be awful, and I can't tell you the consequences of what a G
GMO could do if it wasn't, if it uses proper regulatory procedures that I don't pretend to be not knowledgeable about the future. But I think that, as Bob made sound, limiting may be the best way to go.
All right, the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization, as everybody would agree, has set up international and standardized safety assessments. Okay, that being said, and most of these products are being produced in North America, right? And they can be sold to other countries. Now, we've set up this baseline of information and data on health and safety and environmental testing, right? I mean, we got some, right? We agree to that, we got something. And it's, I would have to say that for a country who wishes to use a product that is built and designed and engineered and used in another country, they're going to have to make their own decisions that if they're going to be able, if they want to use it, they're going to have to assess the product themselves. If they don't think that the environment in India is the same as it is in Missouri, then so be it. They're going to have to take a look at that. And they're going to have to judge the risk for themselves. And if they don't feel that that is safe, then they're going to have to come to their science senses and set up a system by which they're going to assess that product for themselves. Right? They're going to have to make a value. They're going to have to make a value judgment on the thing. They're going to decide if it's worth it. And if they don't feel that this product is designed to work in their environment, they either choose not to buy it, or they're going to have to choose to test it to fit their specifications or not. I mean, if I buy a car that has a seat, that has the driver's seat on the opposite side, I have to make my own decisions whether I'm going to drive it, a British car in this country. So if, by that stupid example, I still have to say that you're going to have to assess the product that you buy.
So it's not necessarily up to us what they do with it. There's already international assessments made. After that point, it's up to you.
Okay. While the judges for topic three put their heads together and, you know, decide which team made the best argument, I'd like to thank every team that participated today. These debates require a large amount of work outside of the normal coursework for every team, and having participated in these last year, it is an awful lot of work, and it can be very stressful, and these teams have all done an excellent job on both sides, including our introductory teams, so we can give them all a round of applause.